KALW.
It's Mother Nature's reward for all your toils. And it's nature's proclamation that life is worth living and coming back.
Today, we head to Oakland to meet some very, very old and very, very short trees.
We laugh and say, the trees are looking so much better, but we've just gotten old.
We meet the dedicated volunteers who care for them. Then we stop and smell the roses.
In its day, at one point, we had 8 full-time gardeners. It was immaculate. It was beautifully groomed.
And a traveling art exhibit makes a stop in Oakland.
Baldwin had many sides to him as well, so I wanted to show that.
Celebrating James Baldwin's 100th birthday. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Tucked away in the heart of downtown Oakland, there's a tranquil garden where redwoods, junipers, oaks, and maple trees grow right alongside one another. And they're all just a few feet tall. They're all bonsai trees, and yes, that is the correct pronunciation.
My joke is American bonsai. It's not bonsai. Bonsai is something you yell in a state of elation and celebration.
Gary Tom is the curator at the Bonsai Garden at Lake Merritt, and KALW's Pat McMahon met up with him to learn more.
Maintenance of a 50-year-old Sequoia sempervirens, or a California redwood, is no easy feat, especially one that is only 3 feet tall.
I mean, if you're a very detail-oriented person and anal, this is a perfect hobby.
Amen.
Each bonsai requires a lifetime of constant manicuring, trimming, and pruning, from its roots to its crown.
They're babied. These things are babied.
Gary Tom embodies this attention to detail. He's the curator here at the Bonsai Garden at Lake Merritt. Today, he stands in the middle of a shaded outdoor workshop.
The tools they're using are also specific to bonsai. They're called commas.
Large empty pots and small gardening tools fill rows of wooden shelves. Gary directs his team of 3 assistants as they scrape away excess soil and moss from the tree's base.
We're plucking those things every 6 to 8 weeks during the growing season. And the joke is in the hobby is that you only want one redwood because they're so labor intensive.
There are over 80 bonsai trees on display in the garden. There are California junipers collected from the Mojave Desert, with trunks like overlapping waves of wood. There are black pines imported from Japan, whose needles angle straight up like a porcupine. There is one question Gary is constantly fielding. What is your favorite tree?
That question's always asked, and I always tell people my favorite tree is the one I've been working on presently.
He points to the redwood the team was tending to earlier in the workshop.
So today we're going to repot that redwood over there.
This particular redwood has a special distinction. It was the very first tree donated to this garden 25 years ago. Its pine branches sweep out and upward from its sturdy trunk.
Interestingly enough, it has number 101 because it was collected from Highway 101 up north when they were doing a widening of the road. And some bonsai person drove by, saw it, and said, "Can I have that?" I lovingly refer to this as roadkill.
Redwood 101 is an example of one way to make a bonsai. Its trunk, which had been the branch of a larger tree, was collected in the wild. It was then potted and cared for until it began to grow roots of its own.
You spend the first year to 3 years letting the tree reclaim its health and showing signs that it's going to be vigorous, and then you let it rest.
Bonsai trees can also be pieced or grafted together. A branch clipping gets attached and bound to the tree's trunk.
You have to line up the live tissues, wrap it very tightly to make sure there's a very tight contact, and then pray that the plant gods are with you and it's going to take.
However a bonsai is started, either from collected wood or from a planted seed, it will continue to be shaped and styled its entire life. As the tree grows, its roots are pruned and branches are trimmed to ensure it stays within official size guidelines. Rarely do they grow past 4 feet tall. These size restrictions even apply to the oldest trees. Gary shows me another crown jewel of the garden, a daimyo oak imported from Japan. It was presented as a gift to U.S. Ambassador Anson Burlingame during the Lincoln presidency over 160 years ago.
This is quite possibly the first bonsai that was ever brought to this country. So this garden is filled with history, filled with memories. That's why it hurts so much when someone just comes in willy-nilly and decides they're going to come in and take something and flip it.
Gary's mood shifts back and forth between excitement and sadness. In January, 8 trees were stolen from the collection, and they still haven't been found. This is the 4th theft in the last few years.
They can't feel or begin to understand how much time and love goes, dedication goes into creating these trees. Oh.
For Gary, that's been almost a lifetime. He's been a volunteer here for as long as this garden has been around. But his love affair with bonsai started even earlier, when he was 11 years old, just up the road at the Lakeside Park Garden Center.
And there happened to be a bonsai show. I walked through that show and my eyes just kind of bugged out and I was mesmerized. And I looked and I said to myself, I'm going to do this when I grow up.
When you've dedicated your life to this process and decades to individual trees, the loss is hard to put into words.
It was hurtful, it's numbing. This last one, taking that tree I worked on for over 20 years, really hurt. It's like they took your pet. And I was joking with the staff. I said, you know, we're not going to mourn for 100 days. We're just going to have to move on.
I think we do. And examples of resilience are all over the garden this time of year. The deciduous trees are beginning to bloom.
It's Mother Nature's reward for all your toils. And it's nature's proclamation that life is worth living and coming back.
Back in the workshop, the team has finished pruning back the roots of Redwood 101. They've picked out a new pot, and they're giving it a thorough rinse.
At this moment in history, I'm trying to go a little larger on pots as a theft deterrent.
Redwood 101 was nearly lost to the robbery in January. Ultimately, it was too big to fit through the hole in the fence.
We're gonna try this drum pot. You see the texture on the outside looks like a Japanese drum.
Carefully, 3 volunteers tackle the process of repotting. They support its trunk with their hands and tilt the tree, lifting it just enough so the new pot can be slid safely underneath.
Okay. Lift. Separate. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my.
Oh, perfect.
Yay!
Look at that.
Okay.
I'm feeling it.
We gotta find it. It's a round pot, right? We still have to find the front.
Yeah, which one?
Moments pass as Gary circles Redwood 101, seated in its new home. Every angle must be examined. Then, finally.
Okay, so this is fine.
The professor approves. Good.
Redwood 101 returns to the garden in its brand new home. Gary jokes with me that he won't be around the next time this tree needs a repotting. This practice of bonsai is one that helps you zoom out, to see the bigger picture, slowly laid out over time.
It teaches you patience. And now I talk to friends of mine, and we've been in this hobby together for almost 50 years. We laugh and say, the trees are looking so much better, but we've just gotten old.
In Oakland, I'm Pat McMahon for Cross Currents.
Pat reported that story as a current fellow in our newsroom's Audio Academy. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, we'll visit another popular garden not too far away. And right now, this one is full of blooming roses. For nearly a century, the Morcom Rose Garden in Oakland's Grand Lake neighborhood has provided beauty and respite to locals and visitors alike. With a dazzling array of several thousand roses, multiple winding walkways, a reflection pool, and fountain cascades, it's hard to deny the public park's magic. In 2022, reporter Raphael Cohen went to meet the volunteers who manage the garden. This is a story from our series, At Work.
A hidden jewel, an urban oasis. That's what the Morcom Rose Garden has always felt like to me. I've been coming to this serene sanctuary sporadically for the past 20 years, but I became a real regular during the pandemic. It provided some relief from the day-to-day chaos, some sensory delight and peace of mind in a period fraught with fear. So I wanted to meet some of the people who make this place go. People like Steve Gary. He's helping to put the final touches on a new irrigation system.
I was born on a ranch in Central Valley, and we had like, I don't know, 350 acres at one point of nectarines, peaches, plums. And so I'm familiar with that kind of agriculture. Now, roses, it's a little different story.
He's been volunteering here for the past 7 years.
My grandmother had zinnias and things like that, and roses I didn't really have an acquaintance with, but I've gotten acquainted. I got some roses at home. They tell you, you know, when you're okay and when you're not doing okay. So, but they're pretty hardy. They're amazing.
Well, I'm a gardener by location.
That's Jane Bisek, another volunteer.
I used to walk through the Rose Garden to go to the casual carpool to work in San Francisco. So after I retired, I thought I should give back to the public space.
Today, she and several colleagues are busy weeding near the reflection pool.
The weeds are winning.
We do have a consulting rosarian that comes every day and works, and he's our teacher.
A rosarian? I'd never even heard the term. But I had seen an older gentleman in jeans and a wide-brim hat around here for years, tending to the rose bushes, whether or not they were in bloom. I'd often wonder what his story was. Now I was about to find out.
Yeah, I'm Royal Krieger, and I'm the a volunteer here. I'm also the rosarian. My wife and I bought a home in the late 70s, and she wanted a little rose garden, and that soon became about 50 roses, and the gardener said, I'm not too sure about taking care of these.
Royal ended up attending a rose pruning demonstration put on by the East Bay Rose Society at the Morcom.
Probably about 4 or 5 years later, I was one of the participants giving these demonstrations.
His career had been in the business world.
But then as I started to divest myself about 10 or so years ago, and then that led to my being the rosarian here, which is, I'll tell you, the happiest hours of my day.
In reaching out to the volunteer group, I kept running across the term dedicated deadheaders.
Anyone can be a volunteer, but to be a deadheader, I have basically a program to teach to make sure they have enough knowledge to be dangerous enough to turn them loose on their own.
I'm city raised and the antithesis of a green thumb, so I needed some clarity on what exactly deadheading entails, because I genuinely thought the name was a reference to the Grateful Dead and the senior volunteers' shared enjoyment of their music. Not quite.
So deadheading is after the bloom has happened, we want to remove that spent bloom.
A dead flower to you and me.
Typically, we want to go to the first or second five leaf. We're going to cut above it about a quarter of an inch. That is now going to stimulate a new growth at that point. As long as we keep deadheading, we'll keep stimulating the plant and we'll keep getting more bloom.
How quickly can someone learn to deadhead properly?
This is a skill that, frankly, takes time. The more skilled that you get, especially with some of the more complex roses, then you'll know in time not only am I pruning for the next bloom, which might be 5, 6, 7 weeks from now, but I'm also pruning down the line even for future years.
He says it's an art.
Think of it in a way of people become masters on bonsai. That's what happens here. And that's really an advanced level of great joy. And I'm always love to teach people, you know, those aspects.
Walking these grounds always brings me great joy. It also feels a bit like time travel, especially when I pass by the cascading fountain.
The city acquired the property about 1915 at the behest of a men's garden club. And then in 1932 to 34, it was a WPA project.
The Works Progress Administration employed millions of job seekers to carry out public works projects. And Alameda-born landscape architect Arthur Cobbledick designed Morecambe based largely on the Italian gardens he'd studied.
Many of the public gardens, you'll find they have pretty much all the same roses, and so I call them mommy pleasers.
But Royal also tries to introduce new ones every year. There are more than 2,500 roses in the Florentine area of the garden.
We have quite a few very, very rare roses. In a couple cases, we believe we probably have the only ones in the world.
That was an excerpt from a story produced by Raphael Cohen. It first aired in 2022. You can find a link at our website to learn how to sign up for a tour of the Morecambe Rose Garden or to find out how to volunteer. All that is at klw.org/crosscurrents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. This year marks the 100th birthday of the writer James Baldwin. To this day, people turn to Baldwin's words to understand racism in America. A traveling exhibit paying homage to the writer and activist has made a stop at the Joyce Gordon Gallery in Oakland. It's called Frontline Prophet, James Baldwin. The pieces are by Detroit artist Sabrina Nelson. Oakland artist Ashara Ekundayo co-curated the exhibit, and they both spoke with KALW's Janae Darden.
Ashara and Sabrina, welcome.
Thank you.
Hello. Thank you for having us on.
Sabrina, I'm going to start with you. Why did you want to create images of James Baldwin?
I was invited in 2016 to the James Baldwin Conference. And I was invited by a writer friend of mine, Jessica Care Moore. On that plane was Melba Boyd and Magdalena from U of M. Melba Boyd is from Wayne State. Jessica, international poet. And she asked me to go with her as an artist to paint James Baldwin image during her plenary session that was called What Would James Baldwin Do? Now, prior to that going, I didn't read enough of his work and I had not drawn him. When I got there, the first session we went to by Rich Blant introducing and welcoming everybody, I started drawing him and I felt the spirit of Baldwin at American University of Paris. And I felt like he chose me. And so in that moment, it was uncomfortable. I was a little bit scared. No one else reacted. I felt a spiritual and a physical touch twice. And then I said in my mind and to his spirit, if you're here, I don't know you like that. I'm going to need you to back up off of me. But if you're going to do this, you're going to have to teach me how to know you. And so I just sat quietly and continued to draw his image. That first sketch is in the cabinet in the back behind the piano at the gallery. And so it's a very loose sketch of him, but it was my first sketch of him and I could feel him in that room.
Ashara, the title of this exhibit is Frontline Prophet, James Baldwin. Why did you choose that title?
Well, you know, as we've been inside of a lot of different kinds of conversations and meditations over the last year, as folks all over the world are celebrating Baldwin's centennial birthday that's coming up, I started to listen to his words, read books about him and essays about him and about his writing. And I came across a conversation by Dr. Cornel West, where he makes a distinction between a prophet and a leader. And in that discussion, he was talking about the leader being someone who has to jump into the middle of a situation, into the middle of a fray, and be prudential. while the distinction that he made around a prophetic person is someone who tells the truth, exposes lies, bears witness, and then is usually pushed to the margins. So I thought about Baldwin and kind of the criticisms of his work, folks who just didn't get it, who called him kind of a common protest writer, his protest novels. And so, you know, I really thought he's on the front line. I'm just witnessing what's happening right now, the genocides and the wars that we're faced with and navigating inside of the cultural community, inside of our families all over the world, and that the words of James Baldwin are being used. So these like messages from the other side of the veil are being used to inspire, to inform, to activate protest, and to, I think, bear witness to the revolution that is happening. And so very much in Baldwin's case, he employs a Black prophetic tradition to design and present a number of pristine and acute considerations on white supremacy. He's deconstructing the American dream. He's just a complex dude.
Tour is going to several cities in North America as well as overseas to Paris. Why stop in Oakland, Ashara?
We were looking at places that were significant to Baldwin, locations in which he either spent a significant amount of time or made a significant statement, a presentation, a lecture. He did spend a fair amount of time in the Bay Area, both in Berkeley and in Oakland. And specifically, he gave a talk to educators and students at Castlemont High School in 1963. That archive lives at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive. You can also find it online on YouTube.
I listened to it over and over and over again on YouTube, and it was really great to hear his voice, but not just to hear his voice, but while I was in Oakland. You know, it does something different when you experience it in the place that it happened.
That's right.
So it's almost like you're calling his spirit to come in to the room, into the moment where it's happening.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the other piece is that I live in Oakland, you know, I'm committed. I chose to live in Oakland, in the city of Oakland. I also live at home in Detroit. And so I thought it was also important for being someone as a cultural worker and an archivist who's interested in Black life, particularly interested in kind of the stories and imaginations of Black creatives, that I mean, I wanted to make sure that this story, that this worldwide conversation with James Baldwin and his life and his wisdom was also shared with Oakland, and the impact and the influence and the importance of Oakland, California in this trajectory around revolution and radical practice.
Sabrina, you show different sides of Baldwin. There's images of him in a pulpit. There's images of him that show his swagger. He had a coolness to him. Images of him in thought. Images of him laughing. And again, if I didn't say, the exhibit is really, really beautiful.
Thank you.
Talk about why you wanted to show us those different sides. I like seeing different sides of activists, you know, and like, not that they were just activists, but that they were full rounded people. So I really like that you did that.
Well, I will say that I am influenced by a lot of things. But first, I will say that we are not one being of what people think we are. And as a writer, or an artivist, as James Baldwin was, an activist, a writer, and a citizen of the world, he had many layers that we didn't get to see. You know, so Baldwin had many sides to him as well. He had the joyous, gregarious side when he's with David. It's a full mouth laugh, his brother, right? And with his friends, where he could just move about the cabin freely. So I wanted to use color, line, canvas, paper, fabric, thread to express the many ways that we see Black men who witness and who have to experience life in the short years that he had, the short journey that he had. And he experienced grief, grace, joy, and also gratitude. He was thankful to be in the position that he was in. So I wanted to show that. And somebody said to me, you know, Baldwin was a serious man and you used all these colors and he's laughing a lot. And I was like, well, people are allowed to rest. Where do freedom fighters go to rest?
You both have ties to Detroit. Ashar, you're based in Oakland, and I know you're from Detroit. And Sabrina, you're based in Detroit. I feel like Detroit and Oakland are like cousins. And I'm just thinking of just the work I've read of Baldwin and some of the things he said. And Sabrina, you have really great quotes from him. I mean, everything he pretty much said was great, but you have really great quotes included in his works. How does Baldwin, Oakland, and Detroit intersect or converse with each other? Ashara?
I'm thinking about timeliness, and Baldwin's popularity coincided with the civil rights movement, with the revolution. I think in terms of how we think about a timestamp or even a time capsule, the work and the critique that Baldwin was offering at the time is, we're talking about fire, the fire next time. So his essays, his statements on politics, I think on what he would call a morally corrupt society and how we move throughout and navigate throughout those places in society is very much around what his writing is about. And so that means that Detroit is part of that dialogue. Oakland, Watts, LA, these are parts of really important locations and sites of protest. And so we place his work, his image, his ideas in that cauldron for consideration, and I think for a particular kind of historical context.
That was curator Ashara Okundayo and artist Sabrina Nelson speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. That interview was co-produced by Porfirio Rangel. You can see Frontline Prophet James Baldwin at the Joyce Gordon Gallery before it ends this Saturday, April 27th. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.